The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Self-inflicted wounds, scandals involving the Benghazi tragedy, IRS investigations, the secret subpoena of press calls, and more beset the White House.
Democracy and danger in Pakistan. A new leader is elected, but old problems persist, from extremism and economic woes to the Afghan war next door.
The Angelina effect, how screen queen Jolie's decision to go public with her double mastectomy may impact larger questions about breast cancer.
Not so great Gatsby, or so says our critic. Also a new Star Trek, the latest Iron Man, and reluctant fundamentalism after 9/11.
Main event, that's M-A-N-E, as in The King of the Jungle. A new book explains one woman's mission to save endangered white lions.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of May 19th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
It put the American people at risk, and trying to determine who was responsible for that, I think, required very aggressive action.
In an email dated September 14th at 7:39 p.m., State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland wrote, "Why do we want the Hill, as in Congress, fingering Anzalah Sharia, when we aren't doing that ourselves?" And the penultimate point could be abused to beat the State Department for not paying attention to agency warnings.
Today, Secretary Liu took the first step by requesting and accepting the resignation of the acting commissioner of the IRS.
My question isn't about who's going to resign. My question is, who's going to jail over this scandal?
At times last week, it seemed the Obama administration just couldn't find enough feet to shoot itself in. Attorney General Eric Holder was belabored for the secret subpoena of Associated Press phone call data after the wire service had cooperated by temporarily holding the story of a terror attack forestalled. State Department spokesman Victoria Nuland's defensive email after the fatal attack on U.S. facilities in Benghazi urged no mention of terrorist suspects and prior CIA warnings. And the president's sacking of the acting IRS commissioner was not enough for House Speaker John Boehner after disclosure that groups with the words Tea Party and Patriot in their names were subject to improper scrutiny when they applied for tax-deductible status as social welfare organizations.
Continuing focus on sex abuse in the military and the capture of an alleged CIA spy at the embassy in Moscow also helped distract from some significant good news. The budget deficit shrinking faster than expected and bipartisan progress on immigration reform in both the House and Senate. To consider these and related political developments, we're joined again by Craig Shirley, Republican public affairs consultant, historian, and Ronald Reagan biographer. His books include Reagan's Revolution, Rendezvous with Destiny, and December 1941. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Melissa.
You noted last week that it was pretty unusual for folks to feel both victimized and vindicated. So for the Tea Party, was the IRS scandal a dream or a nightmare come true?
Well, I'm not sure it's either, except it is confirmation that what they, as individuals around the country, individual groups and Tea Party organizations, suspected, has been proven correct by the Inspector General's report that came out of the IRS, which included the fact that over a 24-month period, not one Tea Party group was approved for tax-exempt status at the same time when dozens, if not hundreds, of progressive and liberal groups were approved. So it confirmed the suspicion that they'd had all along, was that there was an institutional bias, at least in the IRS, against conservative groups.
By contrast, you say some establishment Republican groups might have reason to be embarrassed. Talk about that. And some GOP leaders warning Obama critics not to overreach.
Well, you know, isn't that interesting, David, not American Crossroads or any of the other Republican establishment political organizations that are based in Washington were apparently met any resistance from approval by the IRS. And it points to the schism between the existing ongoing schism between the Republican Party and the insiders and the outsiders, the Tea Party populist conservatives. And I think that it suggests two things. One is that the people at the IRS and the Washington establishment perceive the National Republicans as being a part of the establishment and therefore one of their kin. Secondarily, it suggests that they don't perceive them as a threat to the status quo in the way they perceive the Tea Party as a threat to the status quo. So, in either context, it's bad news for the National Republicans.
Not to deny the political deaf ear of IRS personnel involved, at the very least, would you agree they were not out looking for Tea Party groups but actually responding to a flood of applications for special tax-deductible status from political activists claiming to qualify as social welfare operations not required to disclose their donors?
Well, they didn't go out and actively search out Tea Party groups around the country. You have to go through this process of application for tax exempt status, but the designation of socially active groups is not one that was chosen by the Tea Party, organizations or by the conservatives or anything else. That's a designation that came from Congress and the IRS itself. And so the definition and the interpretation and how much constitutes complete or partial, that all came from the insiders, and that came from Washington. And the Tea Party applicants were simply abiding by the process and the approval process that everybody else was abiding by. So however you look at this, it comes back to the systemic problems inside the IRS and the Washington establishment as a whole.
Whatever motivation is ultimately proved, do you think Congress should finally clarify the tax law on types and levels of political activity still qualifying for tax-deductible status?
Yes, and I think this is a marvelous political opportunity for President Obama. He and leaders in the Republican Party could jump forward by simply saying, the IRS is just too antiquated. It's too burdened by controversy. It's too it's lost too much of its credibility, and we need to redo the entire tax code and eliminate the IRS and institute a fair flat tax for all Americans that kicks in at a certain level, doesn't adversely affect those at the lower wage scales, that kicks in at a middle and upper middle class, eliminate most, if not all, deductions, and simplify the tax code so that you don't have to have expensive accountants and thousands of bureaucrats that are going to be tempted to play with power and to be play with applicants and things like that.
On the Secret Justice Department subpoena, did you sense that some conservatives were a bit uncomfortable defending the free press, the mainstream free press that they usually see as the enemy?
No, I don't think so. I think the First Amendment is for everybody, and especially in the 21st century with the internet and with podcasts and with all the other means of that individuals have, David, of expressing themselves.
What about the press shield legislation that President Obama has asked to be reintroduced? Do you think there'll be bipartisan support for that?
I think there will, Melissa, but I want to look at it closer. But I have my reservations about it. I don't like the idea, first of all, who is to decide who is press and who is not, especially as we just discussed the expansion of communication with new technologies. So who is to say who is a journalist and who is not a journalist? And I don't like the idea of creating a special segregated protected class of journalists that can do and say things that the rest of us can't do or say. So I think we have to look at that very carefully.
A last question. Despite some false quotations suggesting White House interference on the Benghazi talking points, there does seem to be evidence of State Department damage control going beyond what the CIA and the FBI thought necessary. Do you see that becoming a future problem for the Secretary of State at that time, Hillary Clinton, if she runs for president again?
All right, David, 3 years is such a long time. And to illustrate it is that when she was up for confirmation as Secretary of State, is that none of the problems that had visited her and President Clinton during their 8 years in the White House really came back to bite her.
Craig Shirley is a Republican consultant, historian, and Ronald Reagan biographer. His books include Reagan's Revolution, Rendezvous with Destiny, and December 1941.
Quote from the news, the biggest assault on the 40-hour work week in this country in a generation. That was Indiana's freshman Republican Congressman Luke Messer arguing that Obamacare should be repealed because it's forcing employers to cut work shifts in anticipation of new costs. The GOP House majority agreed. It's 37th vote to repeal, but no Senate action is expected.
Next, democracy and danger in Pakistan. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. I can't imagine it all going back into one piece. That was Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, on the fragmenting of Syria in the current civil war. Also last week, President Obama and Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan called again for pressure to oust the Assad regime. But Russia continues to block effective UN action and last week reportedly sent advanced anti-ship cruise missiles to Syria that could counter any sea-based intervention. Now this.
Despite the violence that marked last week's voting in Pakistan, including 11 dead from a Taliban bomb in the financial hub of Karachi, as we heard, the country went on to a historic completion of one elected government and the handoff to another. But the victory of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and his center-right Punjab-based Pakistan Muslim League presents both opportunities and challenges for the nation and for U.S. interests in the region.
Sharif must deal with economic stagnation and domestic terrorism, the war next door in Afghanistan, and longstanding tension with neighboring, also nuclear-armed India. To consider all those factors and more for Your Ears Only, we're joined by Daniel Markey, Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
What did voter turnout despite the violence tell you about the underlying strength of democracy in Pakistan?
Well, for the most part, I think it basically contradicts the notion that Pakistanis don't support a democratic system. There had been some polls that came out shortly before the elections. They suggested that basically Pakistanis were more in favor of military rule or Sharia law rather than democracy. And I think the fact that millions of Pakistanis did come out, about 60% voter turnout, suggests that on the whole that's a wrong assumption.
What about the final fate of cricket star candidate Imran Khan after so much media attention? Was it inevitable after the campaign accident in which he fractured his back? Was a Khan victory ever likely?
Well, I think Imran Khan ran a good race, and what needs to be remembered is that, he didn't do as well. He didn't sweep the elections like Nawaz Sharif did, but he did far better than he had ever done before. So depends on where you set the bar, and I think it's important to recognize that in Pakistan, all voting is local. Each seat is contested at the constituency level. National polls really mean very little. So it depends on the strength of the candidates that you have at the local level and your ability to mobilize people. And that can take time to build up. And I don't think Imran Khan and his party are quite there yet, but they may be there the next time around.
So what political impact do you see from the visit by Sharif to Khan's hospital room, particularly on Khan's initial complaints of voting irregularities?
Well, one of the things that people have been asking about Nawaz Sharif is whether he would be magnanimous in victory. One of the things that's dogged him is his reputation in the past about holding grudges, personal vendettas, ruling kind of ruthlessly when he had the prime ministership twice in the 1990s. And so the idea of him coming right out of the coming out of the gate, trying to work closely with Imran Khan, and as we've seen over the past day or so, meetings with the military as well, these suggest that he's trying to get along better than in the past. And since he did so well in the elections, he can afford to be a little bit more magnanimous.
Some analysts predict that Sharif's longstanding support from the Saudi royal family may help his efforts to revive Pakistan's economy. What's your view on that, and what do you see as his likely first steps in that arena?
Right. The economy is the top issue, and it is true that Nawaz Sharif has good and long-standing ties with the Saudis. In fact, he lived there most of the time when he was in exile during the Musharraf era in Pakistan. But I wouldn't necessarily say that the two have to be connected. Pakistan is a country of nearly 200 million people, and its economy really can only work if it improves trade flows, investment from the outside, and becomes more stable and predictable so that Pakistanis themselves will invest in their own businesses and so on. And that hasn't been the case over the past several years. And while the Saudis may be likely to be helpful, that is perhaps to sell energy at a somewhat subsidized level, back Nawaz Sharif if things get really bad, they can't turn the corner for the Pakistani economy. That's the kind of thing where real reforms are necessary. And the good news is that Nawaz Sharif and his party say that that's what they want to do. Out of the gate, they want to work on energy regulation and reform there, and tax reform, plus also building infrastructure. And these are the kind of things that can really build the economy in real terms.
What does Saudi support and Sharif's past positions on domestic terrorism suggest about his handling of that problem now? There are some doubts he can really be tough enough.
Yeah, I think these are reasonable doubts. And of the various concerns that U.S. officials may have going into the next couple of years with Nawaz Sharif is the question of whether he really will be serious about confronting the problems of terrorism and extremism on Pakistani soil. And past history in the 90s is not encouraging on this score. His political party basically has at least two major constituencies. There are the Punjab-based businessmen and the business community, the industrialists, who support him, who basically want stability and peace, and are anti-extremism, certainly anti-violence, and in favor of opening ties with India, trade ties, and so on. And then there's the other side of his coalition, which is a more to the right, more extreme, has ties and friendship, some sympathy and affiliation with groups that we would consider to be extremists, and some of them even violent terrorists. So the question is how he can basically manage the various parts of his party.
Especially with the nuclear issue in mind, what do you see for Sharif's relations with nuclear neighbor India?
Well, the news is very good. Nawaz Sharif has reached out to the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, and the warm welcome into office is reciprocated by Manmohan Singh. So at first, you know, blush, it seems that things are moving in the right direction. Both sides have invited each other for visits. I think that it's important to recognize that times have changed for Pakistan and for India. Pakistan, I think, increasingly recognizes that India is a real rising power and that the Indian economy is something that they can't ignore. So whereas in the 1990s, where India sort of seemed still a bit stuck in a rut economically, didn't seem to be a rising global power quite yet, Pakistan felt that maybe it could challenge it militarily, diplomatically. Now the mood is different. Pakistanis know that they need to somehow figure out how to normalize relations with India, if not necessarily resolve all of their underlying disputes. And I think Nawaz Sharif is on board with that. So that's a good sign.
What do you expect his stated or unstated policy will be on U.S. drone strikes inside his borders on terrorist targets from the Afghan war?
Well, like basically every other Pakistani politician, Nawaz Sharif has come out firmly and publicly against the drone strikes inside of Pakistan. The real looming question is what he may be saying to U.S. officials more privately and what he may say to them once they come to him and try to explain in terms that he may understand better the utility of drone strikes. And I think that the smart move on the U.S. side would be to keep those conversations very quiet. Nawaz Sharif will want to keep them quiet. And basically to appeal to his understanding of threat and to say to him that many of the U.S. drone strikes that have happened inside of Pakistan, particularly over the last year, have been directed toward individuals, terrorists, who have threatened Pakistanis.
Daniel Markey is Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Quote from the news, "Unfortunately, it's not in a place where I can go and fix it." That was former astronaut John Grunsfeld, whose earlier spacewalks helped repair the Hubble Space Telescope on the new positioning problems aboard the Kepler Space Telescope that so far has found 130 Earth-like planets and nearly 3,000 more that might be.
Next, the Angelina Effect, star power and cancer, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. The jury has made its decision on what happened here. We respect it, but that doesn't mean it's the truth. That was defense attorney Jack J. McMahon after Dr. Kermit Gosnell was sentenced to life in prison without parole in connection with the apparent murder of newborns after unsuccessful abortions. Also last week, the only abortion clinic in North Dakota sued to block a new state law that could shut it down. Now this.
She didn't become a great actress. She didn't become somebody anybody knew. She didn't do anything other than love her children and raise them with so much care. And so she's taught me a lot about the importance of that.
That's what film star Angelina Jolie told ABC News she learned from her mother's life, leading her to mother half a dozen natural and adopted children of her own. which she learned from her mother's death from ovarian cancer at age 56, led to Jolie's announcement last week that she underwent genetic testing and a double mastectomy to lower the risk that breast cancer would steal her from her family, and that she'd soon have her ovaries removed as well.
The surgeries and going public about them won Jolie much praise for bravely managing her health risk, despite the obvious threat to her movie beauty image, and for prompting other women, largely less dependent on their looks, to consider it as well. Maybe too many other women, other experts warned. They noted that the mutated gene BRCA1 that testing found in Jolie shows up in only 1 in 500 women and causes only between 5 and 10% of all breast cancers.
More broadly, new science suggests that even basic mammography may do at least as much harm as good, missing the fastest spreading, most fatal cancers while prompting discomfort, often disfiguring, and expensive treatment of tumors that might never prove fatal. To talk about the Angelina effect and the mixed messages about cancer testing and treatment generally, for your ears only, we're joined again by Fran Visco, president of the National Breast Cancer Coalition, whose website is breastcancerdeadline2020.org. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
News reports say that Jolie's story prompted a significant increase in telephone queries and internet searches about preventive mastectomies. Do you think her star power will make the option more popular than is medically necessary?
I think we do run the risk of that happening. We all respect her very difficult personal choice, and she was very brave to go public with it. But we have to stress the fact that her situation is extremely rare. And most women, the vast, vast majority of women, do not require genetic counseling or genetic testing or prophylactic mastectomy.
Would a massive demand for the kind of genetic testing Jolie had bring the price down from the current $4,000, maybe pressure government and private insurance companies to cover it more than they do now?
Well, the demand is double-edged because if there's a massive demand, most of the people demanding it do not need it. And there should not be insurance coverage for tests that are not needed, that are not medically necessary. So would it bring the price down? I don't know, because Myriad Genetics has a monopoly on the test.
What's your best advice on which women should seek the testing and how they should decide on preventive mastectomy?
Well, women requiring the testing first should undergo genetic counseling. And there are criteria for the women who should go and have that type of counseling. And you can find that information on the website of the National Cancer Institute. But it's primarily a very significant family history of the disease, not, you know, a cousin third removed or even first removed. It's a significant family history.
Broadening the discussion, you were generally sympathetic to a recent New York Times Magazine story about the very limited success of long-touted annual mammograms in reducing actual breast cancer deaths. Talk about that.
Well, the reality is that we haven't reduced deaths by very much, despite the billions of dollars we invested in breast cancer and the decades of raising awareness of the disease. But we have increased mammography usage, and we've increased incidence because we're finding many breast cancers that will never become life-threatening. Times change. You know, science moves forward. We know a lot more. We're more aware of breast cancer. We have more treatments. So the effectiveness or the usefulness of mammography has diminished quite a bit, but the risk of mammography has increased. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean by that you want to screen a healthy population to save lives. We're not saving very many lives at all by mammography, but we are increasing women getting unnecessary toxic treatments, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, that in themselves cause other cancers. So it isn't a simple message, early detection saves lives. It is really a very complicated situation that each woman should very carefully understand and analyze before she makes a personal decision to be screened.
Beyond testing, you've long argued that the government medical insurance complex is too wedded to familiar approaches to breast cancer and too wary of new, potentially more effective approaches. What are the most important factors in that inertia?
I think it's mostly the fact that breast cancer has become a huge business, a very large infrastructure that is more intent on keeping itself going than actually figuring out how we can end the disease. How do we prevent women from getting breast cancer? How can we cure it for those who already have it? so that we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we're not getting anywhere with that approach. You know, we need to shake things up, which is why my organization set a deadline to know how to end breast cancer by January 2020. We need to completely change the way we approach the issues in breast cancer.
Well, give us some idea. What are the kinds of approaches that we don't generally hear about?
We really don't focus enough on primary prevention, on stopping women from getting breast cancer. And we don't focus on the question of how do we stop breast cancer from spreading to other organs. We talk a lot about curing breast cancer that has already spread, which is an incredibly important issue. But if breast cancer stays in the breast, it wouldn't kill anyone. It's the spread to other organs that is deadly. How do we stop that particular process? Those are the two areas that we are focusing on with our deadline campaign.
Many women who've had mastectomies are very, very affected by this emotionally. Do you think Angelina Jolie coming out like this will make things easier for them?
I think it is, it will resonate with women emotionally who have had mastectomies. Someone like Angelina Jolie and, you know, the role she plays in the world of beauty and sexy and talented and all of that. And she lopped off her breasts, and she is pretty clear about the fact that that doesn't change any of the aspects of who she is. That's a very important message to women.
Fran Visco is president of the National Breast Cancer Coalition, whose website is breastcancerdeadline2020.org.
Quote from the news, "I don't want to appear on another program or climb another mountain." That was Barbara Walters announcing that next year she'll end her long TV career of interviews of the powerful and famous that some critics said blurred the line between real journalism and celebrity entertainment.
Next, The Not-So-Great Gatsby, a new Star Trek, and more for your ears only. With more for your ears only, I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Systemic change will only occur when companies take action together. That was a statement from one of several investor, religious, and labor groups urging major American companies like Walmart and Sears to join about 40 European companies in an accord that supports tougher new safety and health laws for factories in Bangladesh. Now this.
New York, 1922. The tempo of the city had changed sharply. The buildings were higher. The parties were bigger. The morals were looser and the liquor was cheaper. The restlessness approached hysteria.
Shall we?
Who is this Gatsby?
Do you know him?
Oh, yes, we know Gatsby, Jay Gatsby, from novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby and the Gatsbys of numerous film versions. What we just heard was from the trailer of the latest version, Baz Luhrmann's, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Maybe not so great, but only one option for you in this year's first crop of summer cinema.
From Iron Man 3, whose take at the global box office just passed the $1 billion mark, though it may be the weakest of the trilogy so far, to the latest Star Trek prequel, and from a journey across the Pacific on a balsa wood raft in Kon-Tiki to a journey towards terrorism for a Pakistani in America and back home after 9/11 in The Reluctant Fundamentalist. There's a lot to consider, and to do that for your ears only, we're joined again by Boston Globe critic Ty Burr. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with Luhrmann's Gatsby, yet another film of Fitzgerald's literary novel. This one stars DiCaprio, as we said, as Jay Gatsby, and Luhrmann's trademark grab bag of flash and dash. How great all in all?
It is a mixed bag. There are some real flaws. I think it is certainly the most stylistically ambitious Gatsby so far, and I think Luhrmann is actually, in a weird way, he's the appropriate man for the job, in that somebody, you know, what you have to do with this story is get across the flash and the bang of the roaring 20s, the jazz age. And stylistically, you know, he does that more than anybody else who's tried to put this on film.
Purists of the literary work have been scandalized by Luhrmann's decision to score the party scenes to songs by another Jay, hip-hop's Jay-Z. Not exactly the music of the Roaring Twenties. Is it artistic vision or crass commercial appeal to young viewers and music downloaders?
Oh, I think the purists have got their nose out of joint on this one. You know, they wouldn't complain if they went to see, you know, a classic opera updated to the modern era. You know, but if you do it with a classic literature and a movie, you can't do it. Baz Luhrmann's point, and I think it's well taken, even if you know you don't agree with it, is that classic jazz music of the era does not scandalize us, as good as it is, and in fact, it's been completely accepted by, you know, by modern viewers as good music and appropriate to the period. He wanted something that would push people's buttons and really get across how just out of control and scandalous this scene seemed to people of the time. And the fact that a lot of people are saying, oh, poo-poo, you can't do that, I think actually proves his point. I think the music's pretty good on its own, and it certainly works well, I think, in context of the party scenes, which are completely over the top and should be.
What about DiCaprio?
I think he's great. I think he's actually the best Gatsby that has been in the movies so far because much more than Robert Redford, he lets you see the insecure guy, the insecure Jay Gatsby behind the supremely confident Jay Gatsby.
On to Star Trek Into Darkness, a sequel to 2009's hugely successful reboot of the Star Trek franchise helmed by the same director, J.J. Abrams. Does it live up to that film?
It almost does. I went into that first Star Trek, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, thinking, prove it. That I'm kind of done with this franchise. And Abrams was able to, through smart casting and good screenwriting and just good blockbuster filmmaking, get me completely on board the Enterprise again. And then the thrill of that first movie was being reunited or reintroduced to these characters played by different actors, but in a way that really kept the spirit. That thrill is not here in the second one because we've already met them and we're kind of back to business as usual. That said, it is a really good, fun summer blockbuster, and it shows how Abrams is just able to work within these cliches and tropes of action movie blockbuster, filmmaking, and make it matter and make it feel really like you're really there and feel really alive.
But
when you compare it to something like Iron Man 3, I mean, it's no comparison.
But you found something unsettling about the film that had nothing to do with the film itself, really. What was that?
Well, and this is also true of Iron Man 3 in that both of the films include scenes of early on terrorist bombings in America or in Star Trek Into Darkness's case of London, where especially in the Star Trek movie where Captain Kirk is searching the video footage to find the perpetrator. It has these unsettling echoes of what we in Boston have just been through and as a nation, and it just makes me realize how our popular culture has trouble confronting a lot of this stuff, but they don't have a problem sort of remulching it into popular entertainment. And it's a very odd sensation to be watching these movies and seeing how they take these topical notions and put them into popular entertainment.
Well, let's turn to The Reluctant Fundamentalist, based on the acclaimed 2007 novel by Mohsen Hamid, which also arrives at this somewhat uncomfortable time, especially in Boston after the Marathon bombings. What's the plot? Pardon the expression.
The plot is about a Pakistani man who's gone to Princeton and has worked on Wall Street and has achieved the American dream, and then 9/11 happens, and he begins to be pushed out of the American dream and to think twice, and he ends up moving away from America, and everybody assumes things about him which are not necessarily to be assumed. It takes the form of a monologue. It's very thoughtful. It makes you think about the way everybody profiles everybody else based on the way they look or seem. The movie, which is directed by Mira Nair, who's a very good director, adds this additional plot of a sort of thriller spy terrorist thing going on the outside. It doesn't really benefit the movie.
And the cast, which includes an American quite famous for being an anti-terrorist?
Oh, Kiefer Sutherland. Well, he's actually got a small role as the lead character's Wall Street boss, and it has nothing really to do with Jack Bauer. But Riz Ahmed in the lead, he's really terrific. He's a young and up-and-coming actor, and he really gets across the conflicts and contradictions and nuances of this man who remains peaceful yet is struggling with this country that is struggling with him.
Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr is a frequent guest on this program and author of Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame from Pantheon.
Quote from the news, he's the Marilyn Monroe of soccer. That was Stefan Szymanski, author of Soccernomics on international soccer star David Beckham, after he announced last week he would retire at age 38 from a career that combined extraordinary athletic skill, image management, and product marketing with a popular good guy image.
Next, The Lady and the Lions, for your ears only. A bit more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. They have never distinguished between the innocent and the guilty. That was Kali Al-Ghazali of the Moderate Northern Elders Forum in northern Nigeria on President Goodluck Jonathan's escalation of brutal military action against Islamist extremists there, which already has killed approximately 4,000 people over the past 4 years, many of them innocent civilians. Now this.
Forget the mascot of so many MGM features. That was the real thing. The roaring of a rare African white lion and the adorable effort by an even more rare white lion cub. Following Endangered Species Day last Friday, we turn to a guest who's made the rescue and revival of that species her life's main mission, M-A-N-E, pardon the pun. She's former London model and ad agency veteran Linda Tucker, founder of the Global White Lion Protection Trust and author of Saving the White Lions, One Woman's Battle for Africa's Most Sacred Animal, new from North Atlantic Books. And for your ears only, Linda Tucker is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
How many white lions are there around the world today, in the wild, protected areas, zoos, and what they called canned hunting preserves for visitors to shoot?
That's an important question, and it's hard to determine because many of these places don't keep records. So I think the really important question is how many are surviving in the wild, and that's a critically endangered number. Only 9 in our reintroduction program roam free in the wild, and 5 additional individuals in respective prides. So you're looking at, all in all, a number under 20 in their natural habitat.
What makes them or makes them considered Africa's most sacred animal?
The belief is that the white lions come from the stars. It's a lovely legend, and it's backed up by a lot of mythology and culture. And so the name itself of the lands where they originate, the only place on Earth, which is called Simbavati, you hear the word Simba, meaning lion, and Vati, meaning to come from the heavens, the place where the star lions come down.
Let's go back to where you and your interest in the white lion began, with a scary safari confrontation and a miraculous rescue.
Yes, well, it's quite a story. I was trapped in the middle of a pride of lions, 24 lions in all. One dark night, someone in our group was going to be consumed, no doubt, because we were behaving like prey and lions, you know. Lions run after prey. Anyway, it was a very dangerous situation. And the amazing thing is that we were rescued by an indigenous medicine woman who walked on foot without a light, with a baby attached to her back, strapped to her back, and she walked straight through the lions to come to our rescue. Well, can you imagine? I went back to my life in advertising, fashion, modeling, and it all seemed so superficial and artificial when the real world was out there in the African wilderness with this incredible lion-hearted woman, you know, who was the most amazing woman I'd ever met in my life. So I decided to give up that world of glamour and to return to the heart of Africa and take up my calling there.
You raised money not only to buy your first lions, but to acquire land into which they could be safely released. How many lions did you start with? How much land and where?
Well, bear in mind, we've now secured 5,000 acres of wilderness lands in the middle of their ancestral lands. However, on all borders, lions may be hunted legally in South Africa. So it's a high-risk area. It's an endangered, it's a protected area that we've created, but on our borders, the white lions are still at risk, despite their numbers being so critically low.
Talk about the first real lion family you created, the survival questions and the emotions surrounding its release to the wild.
Well, the first lion I rescued, amazingly, was born in a place called Bethlehem on Christmas Day. But Bethlehem in South Africa is actually the center of a notorious animal breeding center where endangered animals are bred not to be freed but to be killed in cages. And so this little lion cub, had her parents had been stolen from the wild, and she was they were bred, and she was the first white lion cub in captivity. So it was a very dangerous mission I had to take up, but I rescued her from this place, and she and her offspring were the first white lions to return to their ancestral lands.
What are your immediate plans for your preserve priorities?
We see it as a strategic process, step by step. So, yes, there's a lot of funding involved. We actually have numerous U.S. sponsors who are really magnificent. Our main sponsor is our patron, Cheryl Leach. You might remember her name as the creator of Barney the Purple Dinosaur. Huh. Well, through her generous funding, we have secured one of the present title deeds in the lands that we're protecting. But we're looking at a large plan, a plan that protects the whole river corridor in what is known as a biosphere, a United Nations biosphere, that is the greater area where the white lions occurred naturally.
Linda Tucker is a South African-born former model and ad agency veteran in London, now a wildlife conservationist and author of Saving the White Lions, One Woman's Battle for Africa's Most Sacred Animal, from North Atlantic Books. Her website for donation and information is whitelions.org.
Hush, my baby, don't fear, my darling, the lion's least
South Africa's Ladysmith Black Mambazo sings The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, FeedBurner.com, and the Stitcher.com app for mobile devices. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions with interns Laura Ainstrom and Justin Griffith. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the GateWave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation, for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. I'm David Alpern.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Justin Griffith. This week last year, we considered the precarious economy of Greece and threats to the larger Eurozone, a major market for U.S. exports, from our May 20th, 2012 broadcast hosted by Melissa and David.
Through the introduction of the euro and through the crisis we've experienced, we now have more sincere discussions. We have to find harder solutions. Just because we belong to different parties doesn't mean we cannot work together.
For a little while anyway, happy cheers brought forth by passing of the Olympic flame to Britain's Princess Anne in Athens last week drowned out the sound of ATM machines that have been churning out what now totals nearly $1 billion in euros by Greeks fearing that their savings will soon be devalued when the country is forced to quit the eurozone. Political stalemate among major and minor parties of the left and right prompted scheduling of yet another election, as German Chancellor Angela Merkel talked in only the vaguest terms of compromise with a new leading opponent of her austerity demands, just elected French President François Hollande.
Can Europe afford to let Greece go? Will it lead to further dismantling of the European Financial Union? What would that mean for America's economy and the world? And what can be done to prevent the crisis, or at least manage it? To consider those questions for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by French economist Nicolas Veyron, senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank and visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Welcome back to our broadcast.
Thank you.
Some experts say that your Eurozone neighbors are already assuming a massive Greek default and departure from the Eurozone without all that much wider damage. Others see a spreading economic paralysis. But you've expressed doubts that Chancellor Merkel and other leaders can really afford to let that happen.
Well, indeed, there's a lot of brinkmanship, and I would even say there's a lot of bluffing, both from the part of Greek party leaders and also, I suspect, on the part of some European leaders that are on the other side of the negotiating table. The problem being that there is not really a negotiating table right now because there's no real government in Greece. There's a caretaker government, but the crisis is precisely that no coalition has been formed. So we have to wait to a certain extent until the next round of elections in Greece in June and hoping that there will be a government formed and then a true negotiation that cannot really happen now. But I do believe, I am certainly among those who believe that a Greek exit would be necessarily disruptive, very disorderly, and something that European leaders really want to avoid and are ready to go quite far to avoid.
Well, you've been encouraged by some remarks by Chancellor Merkel. What do you see her and other European leaders actually doing short term in the face of continued Greek refusal to go along with at least as much austerity as has been required for the additional bailout support they've been getting?
My impression is that the central banks of the euro system will support the Greek banking system until a negotiation can take place, and therefore nothing disorderly should happen between now and the negotiation in the second half of June.
Well, on balance, so far, international financial instability has actually helped the U.S. economy, pouring waves of foreign wealth into Treasury notes. They're so much safer that Washington has to pay remarkably low interest on the new debt. What impact do you see in the U.S. if Greece actually has to quit the euro?
Well, first, Treasury notes are indeed with low interest rates. That doesn't mean they're safe. And we've seen that before because precisely part of the Greek crisis is that Greece was able to borrow at very low rates when it joined the Eurozone. And now it seems like it was a misjudgment by the marketplace. So I just don't want to say the U.S. is like Greece. It's not. It's much more solid. That said, I think what the U.S. has to fear is not a problem in Greece, which is a relatively small economy, but the consequences of what would be a disorderly situation in Europe as a whole, and to take a bit of a dramatic language, a European meltdown, and this would be very negative for the U.S. economy because all the trade and financial links between the U.S. and Europe.
In the long term, you stress the importance of a European banking union. What would that entail beyond what exists now? How would it help?
Well, basically, the question is whether the European Union can have a monetary union, at least for those countries that adhere to the Eurozone, without having an integrated space for banking and an integrated banking policy. And in the U.S., the answer eventually has been no. We need a national banking system. This has been built in several steps during the Civil War, at the creation of the Fed, later when barriers to cross-border state banking were dismantled. So it has taken a long time in the U.S., but eventually the U.S. history shows that it's very difficult to have a monetary union on a continental scale without having an integrated banking system. And I think we're facing exactly the same problem in Europe right now. We do have relatively consistent banking regulation in the different member states of Europe, but the supervision and the crisis resolution framework is strictly national. That's not sustainable, and probably this crisis is going to accelerate in Europe an evolution that has taken in a different period, of course, and under different financial and economic conditions has taken a long time in the U.S.
You also say that broader stability would be enhanced by moving something called the Financial Stability Board of Major Economic Powers to Asia.
Oh, that's a completely different issue. So we're leaving Europe and we're looking at the global scale. The Financial Stability Board is something that used to be called the Financial Stability Forum, had been created after the Asian crisis of the late 90s, has been expanded and renamed and empowered to do more by the G20 group of the 20 largest economies following the Lehman crisis and the financial crisis of 2007-2008. So it's a bit of a work in progress, but basically this is a sort of watchtower at the global level of the global financial system and of what global financial regulators and also to an extent national financial regulators are doing to keep the financial system stable. The reason why I think it would be sensible to move the secretariat of this organization, it's a very tiny secretariat, about 20-25 people who are currently based in Basel in Switzerland. The reason I think it would make sense to move them to Asia is that currently Asia is a growing part of the financial system. Depending how you measure it, it's between 20% and 30% maybe of the global financial system now and growing almost by the day. But they have not very much of an ownership, a sense of ownership, a sense of buy-in into the global financial authorities that are around. So I think we have to recognize that Asians are increasingly central to the global financial system.
French economist Nicolas Varon is a senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank and a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington.
Greece on the Verge, from our May 20, 2012 broadcast. The latest report from the European Economic Commission said the Greek economy would grow again by 0.6% next year, with unemployment expected to drop gradually from 27% to 21% by 2016. And the Greek government said it aimed for at least a partial return to the bond markets next year. Across the eurozone, construction fell for the fifth month in a row, and economic output fell at an annualized rate of 0.9%. A new Pew survey showed popularity of the European Union down from 60 to 45% since last year, but still over 60% confidence in the euro currency. I'm Justin Griffith. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, all of Ladysmith Black Mambazo with The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
A family live close to the jungle. At the end of the day, they all sit together around the fire. They have their supper, then relax and talk a little. The youngest boy becomes afraid. He hears all the sounds of the wild animals in the forest. Cheetahs, wolves, jackals and lions. He starts crying at the darkness and wild sounds that fill him with fear. Then his mother takes him in her arms and sings to him. The family is always strong together. They protect one another. Grandparents, his father and mother, uncles, aunts, cousins, brothers and sisters. They all join and sing together. Soon he falls asleep. Only the beautiful song fills his ears.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. Hush, my baby, don't fear, my darling, the lion sleeps tonight. Hush, my baby, don't fear, my darling, the lion sleeps tonight.
Yeah.